Bhagavatam, 8th canto, chapter 23, the demigods regain the heavenly planets. Text 29. We'll go back to the text that we passed over because of no purport. Just for the information of those who don't know where we are, we're in the part of the Bhagavatam, 8th canto, after Lord Vamanadeva has given the demigods back the universe. Bali Maharaj has gone to the planet Sutala. And now the Lord is instructing Shukracharya, that priest of Bali Maharaj, that ritualistic priest with only qualifications in doing fruitive or karmic rituals. The Lord is instructing him indirectly in how to understand transcendental reality. The Lord told Shukracharya that, please, in the assembly of the Brahmanas here, describe the faults or discrepancies that your disciple, Bali Maharaj, committed while engaged in yajna and sacrifice. When you speak the faults in the association of the Brahmanas, those faults will be rectified, nullified. Now, Shukracharya realized this is the Lord's indirect way of saying, why did you curse your disciple who was faultless? In Vedic culture, everything has class and finesse. In contemporary so-called culture, you just hit on someone. Why did you do this? Wrong. But the Supreme Personality of Godhead is the most eloquent. And he's speaking to high-class living entities. Shukracharya is a priest on the heavenly planets. He's not an ordinary earthling. Therefore, you see Lord Vamanadeva giving him some respect. So instead of saying, you cursed your disciple, not a Vaishnava disciple, but a Karmakandya disciple. Disciple in terms of material activities for elevation of heavenly planets. You cursed Bali Maharaj because he made some faults. Now, please, in the assembly of the Brahmanas, enumerate those faults. And then, when those faults are enumerated in such a saintly atmosphere, those faults will be nullified. Shukracharya gets the point. And immediately, he eloquently admits he was wrong, saying, if one has fully satisfied you, where is the chance of discrepancies or faults in his performance of yajna, sacrifice? Shukracharya goes on. There may be discrepancies in pronouncing the mantras and observing the rituals of these yajnas. But if your lordship's holy name is chanted, everything becomes faultless. In this way, Shukracharya has come to his senses. Still, he's after declaring the transcendental point, Shukracharya says, all right, I must obey your order. You have ordered me to enumerate the technical faults of the yajna. I must act according to your order, because obeying your order is most auspicious and is the first duty of everyone. I remember, this is the same Shukracharya who earlier told Bali Maharaj, he's Vishnu. Vamana is Vishnu. Don't give him everything. How can you be religious if you give everything? A poor man cannot be religious. In order to be religious, you need money. If you give all your money to Vishnu, then how can you follow Dharma? Sounds pretty good, yes? You are not responsible to keep a promise that will leave you in a poverty-stricken condition, because you need money in order to perform religion. and especially in order to give me donations. Sripacharya relies on the dakshina from his ritualistic followers. So he was worried if Bali Maharaj gives away all his wealth to Lord Vamadev, how will I get some dakshina to maintain my family? That's why Sripacharya has his name, which means the acharya whose qualification is that he comes in seminal succession. His father was a priest, his father's father was a priest, therefore he's a priest. That's his qualification. His very name lets you know what's going on. Real qualification is spiritual qualification. That cannot be inherited. Although, of course, if one takes birth in the family of devotees, you have a first-class chance to be a devotee. But it's like saying, for example, our Sati Roy Prabhu, he's a successful business person. Now, does that automatically mean that anyone born in his family will be a successful business person? No. It means they have a very good chance to pick it up, but doesn't mean it's automatically guaranteed, just by birth. So Shukracharya's qualification is Shukra, seminal, biological, genealogical, not spiritual. So now he has seen the power of Vamanadeva. He has seen the exalted position that Bali Maharaj has gotten because he surrendered everything to the Supreme Lord. Bali Maharaj has been sent to the lower planets as punishment. Apparent punishment. You didn't fulfill your promise, Lord Vamanadeva told him. You promised me 3 steps, and I've covered all the universe with 2 steps. What should I do with my 3rd step? And Bali Maharaj told the Lord Udukram, the great stepper, Mahakram, Trivikram, Lord who took the 3 steps. Those are all different names of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Devotees should always relish meditating on the various holy names of the Lord. Vamana, Upendra, the brother of Indra, because appeared from Aditi, Indra's mother. So he's also known as Upendra. Chivikram, the one famous for taking the 3 steps. Mahakram, the one who takes the biggest steps imaginable. Udukram, the great, the one who takes the great steps. Okay. So, Bali Maharaj thought, I have no place to put the Lord's 3rd step. He's covered the whole universe with 2 steps. But the possessor of the wealth must be greater than the wealth itself. Therefore, I'll ask the Lord to put his final step on my head. This way, Bali Maharaj surrendered everything. Later, Lord Vamadev pointed out, you actually didn't fulfill your promise. You promised me 3 steps. I took everything with 2 steps. Therefore, you have to go to the lower planets for breaking your promise. You see, in Vedic culture, promises are very important, very sacred. In contemporary society today, promises mean nothing. I promised you, but that was last month. This month, things are different. And everyone will nod their head in approval. Yes, makes complete sense. Circumstances are different. I'm feeling different. This is actually not the proper way for human beings to live, but it's very acceptable these days. Even when people take initiation vows, well, when I took the vows and said I would follow the regular principles and chant minimum 16 rounds every day, I really meant it when I said it. But, you know, as the years have gone by, you know, I've become more mature, and you know, that was something I did when I was young. I mean, I still, of course, believe in Krishna. So in this way, persons can just go out the back door and break their promise. But that's considered very severe in Vedic culture. Just like in Ram Lila, Dasarath had promised his queen, who tended him on the battlefield after he was mortally wounded, very severely wounded. She tended him, and as a gallant Kshatriya, what did Maharaj Dasarath say? You may take from me any benediction you like. The affection of a Kshatriya and a husband. You have pleased me by your service. Ask whatever benediction you will. And his wife, what was her name?
Kaikeyi.
She's very clever. She said, oh, I will not ask for anything now, but in the future. Little did Maharaj Dasarath know that his offer of benediction would turn up at such an inconceivable moment. The night before Ram is to be incarnated as king, and all of Ayodhya is in a joyful mood that cannot be measured, because the Supreme Personality of God is about to be crowned monarch of their city. At that moment, Kaikeyi brings up the benediction. She staged the whole thing very nicely. She went to the sulking room of the palace. See, everything is very classy and cultured in Vedic life. There's even a section of the house, a room, where ladies go and they want to be moody and sulk. Very practical. And so the husband gets the point. Without a whole big drama, you know. The servants come tell the husband, well, your wife's in the sulking room. So the man knows, well, I must, you know, I must do something. You know. Not a whole public drama. You better put one in your new... So, Kaikeyi is sprawled out on the floor. You know, she's really into the drama. Her hair is in disarray. Her clothes are scattered, you know. And Dasarath Maharaj becomes, what's wrong? What's wrong? What's wrong? What's wrong? You know. From there, things just get worse. She tells him, of course, send Ram to the forest. Exile him. Make my son, the son born of my womb, king. And Dasarath Maharaj, he practically collapses unconscious. And then she chides him. What kind of man of honor are you? You made a promise. You're not going to keep it? Adds insult to injury. She asks for such a benediction, and then she rubs salt into the wound. You promised. I'm just asking you to fulfill your promise. Why are you hesitating? So this is Vedic culture. And Ram, he supported the promise without hesitation. Father, if you promise that, then I'll certainly comply without hesitation. In this way, Ram becomes celebrated as demonstrator of such high integrity. And in the Shastra, this incident is shown as an example of how the genuine disciple takes the order of the spiritual master. Ram took the order of his father without hesitation and immediately said, I will go to the forest. Not a problem for me, father. But of course, Dasarath was practically dead from grief. And after Lord Ram indeed went to the forest, Dasarath couldn't live because of so much grief. So he left the world. But that shows you the power of promise in a real civilization. But as we said, in today's Togo culture, promises mean nothing. Often now, people don't even bother to make promises because everyone knows, you know, it's just a lost commodity. It's just something that makes no sense anymore. How many times these days in your ordinary dealings has someone said to you, I promise that I will... They don't even say that anymore. They just expect you to understand that when circumstances change, their commitment will change. And this attitude is brought even into Krishna consciousness, this Kali Yuga. attitude. Perhaps you may call it Western dog honor. Don't even bother making a promise. I think we spoke before how in cases when people, in which people still get married, which doesn't happen in the majority of cases, even in a so-called Christian country like the USA, the latest statistics are that more people are not marrying than are marrying. So, even the marriage vows are being altered for those who take them. You change. Instead of saying, we will be together through sickness and health, poverty and wealth, we'll be together till death do us part. Now they change the words in the marriage vows to, we will be together as long as the love lasts. Or we will be together as long as our relationship is productive for society. But some of them even get a bit poetic. Some Hollywood stars. We will be together as long as there's petrol in the tank. When the petrol runs out. Meaning. And in the traditional marriage vows, if they marry in a traditional church, the woman makes a promise of subordination. Of course, that's a complete joke these days. So therefore they're thinking, why even make jokes like this? So one Hollywood star came up with a very good innovation. She changed the vows to, I promise to love you, but not obey you. So, this is the value of promises these days. No one even wants to make them anymore. Now, how can society go on without any kind of honor and integrity? Sooner or later, there's only one conclusion. You have to live in a police state. Because no one has any honor, no one has any integrity. You just have to make the law enforcement stronger and stronger and stronger. Now, this is what they do in the USA. The local city police force, then the state police, then the FBI. There's no culture of integrity and honor. So, just take the taxpayers' money and make the law enforcement agency stronger and stronger. That'll be the only way to go. You'll see it happen in Australia too. That's the only way society will be able to stay together for its materialistic purposes of economic development. There's no integrity, there's no character, there's no promises. Therefore, everything has to be ruled by law enforcement. And the citizens pay for it, and they'll suffer from it. Electronic surveillance is so easy to do. Under the guise of protecting the people, everything is snooped upon. So this is the way, this is the only glue that is left for society once there's no more honor, integrity, or promises. It's obvious. Think about it. Generally what holds the people together is culture. Common shared values, common shared morals. But when that disappears, there has to be something else to hold people together. So the idea was, forget religion as a binding force, make economics, money, the binding force. But now it's clear that's not enough. If you just let everybody, you set everyone free to make as much money as they can without any principles, without any integrity, you'll have huge crime rate, you'll have so much plundering going on. So, how do you make it so that only those in power can plunder? That's the idea. You have to have a strong law enforcement agency, and you tax the citizens for that. Now, Shukracharya was instructing Balimaraj before Balimaraj lost everything. You don't have to keep your promise to Vishnu, because by this promise you'll lose all your wealth, and without wealth you can't be religious. And Shukracharya had further explained, you are allowed to be duplicitous in the case of giving donations. It is allowed. If some beggar comes to your door and asks for a donation, you are allowed to lie and say, I don't have anything. I've already given. That's okay. Shukracharya gave his blessings for that. And then he came up, Shukracharya came up with his ultimate clause. Actually, when you promised Vamanadeva 3 steps of land, you did not say Om before the promise. And according to such and such, he pulled out some very obscure shastra, you know, some technical point. According to the technical points in such and such a shastra, if a promise is not preceded by Om, the promise is not valid. So, as you know, Bali Maharaj rejected that. He thought deeply because he was going to disobey his guru. Now, bear in mind, Shukracharya is not a Vaishnava guru. He is acting as a good karma, punya priest. So, it is not that Bali Maharaj is disobeying his Vaishnava guru. No, Bali Maharaj understands. Here's a chance to surrender the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Isn't that what it's all about? So what? If this Brahmana boy is indeed what Shukracharya says he is, if he's the Supreme Lord, so be it. Let me give him everything. In this way, I will achieve eternal fame. He's a Kshatriya, so Kshatriya is always concerned with fame. But this is the proper way to be concerned with fame. I will surrender everything. Rare it is that such opportunities come to give charity to the most suitable person. I'll do it. Now, after Lord Vamadeva confiscated the universe, Shukracharya has come to his senses. And he is saying, Lord Vishnu, I must act in obedience to your order. You've ordered me to enumerate the discrepancies in the yajna. Actually, there's no discrepancy because the holy name was chanted. But anyway, you've asked me to do that, and so following this order is the first duty of everyone. You see how his tune has changed. So, Shukadeva Goswami continued. In this way, the most powerful Shukracharya accepted the order of the Supreme Personality of Godhead with full respect. Along with the best brahmanas, he began to compensate for the discrepancies in the sacrifices performed by Bali Maharaj. And now in the preceding, in the next verses, you're going to hear how Lord Vamanadeva gave all the land taken away by Bali Maharaj back to Indra. And you'll hear how the whole universe and all the demigods are very happy to accept Lord Vamanadeva as the supreme master of everyone and everything. Not Indra. And this decision made all living entities extremely happy. Indra was considered the king of all the universe, but the demigods accepted Upendra, that is Lord Vamanadeva, as the supreme master. Indra also accepted that. And in a grand celestial parade, they brought Lord Vamanadeva to the heavenly planets. Indra regains his position. He's feeling very fearless and satisfied. Indra's quite a controversial character. But remember, he is a devotee. He's a devotee attached to enjoyment and control. So you must be respectful of Indra. At the same time, mindful of some tendencies he has. Everyone is now chanting the glories of the Lord throughout the universe. And Shukadeva Goswami concludes, O Maharaj Parikshit, pleasure of your dynasty, I have now described to you everything about the wonderful activities of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Vamanadeva. Those who hear about this are certainly freed from all the results of sinful activities. Last night at our gathering at Atma Yoga, after explaining to some of our regulars how their happiness and distress are already prepackaged, they were a bit astonished to hear that. No matter how hard they try, they cannot increase the amount of happiness that they're due in this life, materially speaking. So just to help them understand that, when I said, how many of you here have longed for distress, have hankered for distress? No one did that. But still, distress comes, even though you don't long for it. You don't work for distress. It comes. Similarly, you don't have to worry about your happiness. You don't have to strive for it. It'll come anyway in the right amount that you're due. Hey, we're not supposed to try to be happy. What are we supposed to do then? So this way I was explaining the knots, the hard knots of material life. Take a rope and you tie one knot, on top of that another knot, tie another knot, the knots just get more and more numerous and tight, and it's very hard to untie. Maybe you had that experience sometimes, you had laces in your shoes and you just tied the knot too tight. It's really hard work to, you know, to untie. So this is the condition in the heart of the conditioned soul. Very difficult to untie those knots because of engagement in karmic activity, which leads from one knot to another. You think, I'll just act in this way, I'll just get this, and I'll be all right. But no, things don't stop there because the illusory energy is carrying you along. So if you do get that thing you want, then you want something else, and then there are complications brought about by possessing that thing, unforeseen circumstances, so the knots just start adding up. How to cut those knots? As stated in the first canto of Bhagavatam, Vijyante Hridaya Granthis. Those knots in the heart can be cut by devotional service. And then you will see the self as the master, not the modes of nature as the master of your life. You'll see the spirit self serve to Krishna as the master. In one sense, conditioned souls can be called Prabhu. Master, Lord, in that they are responsible for their implication in material life. So in that sense, everyone is Prabhu in conditioned life. They have exercised their choice to be an illusion. Therefore, in that sense, they are Prabhu. That's about as far as you can be Prabhu, though, in material life. Once you exercise your Prabhu inclinations, choosing to be under the gun of material nature, then you are a subject, you're a slave. But you chose that slavery as Prabhu. Shukadeva Goswami explains, those who hear about this pastime, Lord Vamadeva, are certainly freed from all the results of sinful activities. Yes, last night after hearing all about the grip of karma, the entanglement, the prepackaged happiness and distress, someone just kind of like blurted out, is there any way out of all this? I said, yes. Lord Krishna in Bhagavad Gita says, you approach him and he will eradicate all your hard knots, all the entanglements. Do not fear. Quite a few of them just sighed with relief. A few of them agree, yes, this sounds like a very good proposition. Now, in today's verse, Shukadeva Goswami is saying, one who is subject to death cannot measure the glories of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Trivikrama, Lord Vishnu, any more than he can count the number of atoms on the entire planet Earth. No one, whether born already or destined to take birth, is able to do this. This has been sung by the great sage Vasishtha. You see, in Vedic circles, you always quote authority, even a preeminent authority as Shukadeva Goswami is referring to predecessors. This has been sung by the great sage Vasishtha. Even in Bhagavad Gita, Lord Krishna refers to Vedanta Sutra, refers to great sages, to show you what the standard is. When you quote an authority, it adds prestige and significance to your words. So here is Shukadeva Goswami, a preeminent authority, yet he's still saying, this has been sung by the great sage Vasishtha, and that adds potency, it adds significance. This is also part of Vedic culture. Shukadeva Goswami has the right to say what he did. But just to further make the point very beautiful and powerful, he footnotes by saying, Vasishtha has also said the same thing. Now, we'll read the purport. Vasishtha Muni has given a mantra about Lord Vishnu. Nate Vishnu Jayamano Najato Mahimna Param Anantanapa. No one can estimate the extent of the uncommonly glorious activities of Lord Vishnu. Unfortunately, there are so-called scientists who are subject to death at every moment, but are trying to understand by speculation the wonderful creation of the cosmos. This is a foolish attempt. Long, long ago, Vasishtha Muni said that no one in the past could measure the glories of the Lord, and that no one can do so in the future. One must simply be satisfied with seeing the glorious activities of the Supreme Lord's creation. The Lord therefore says in Bhagavad Gita, Vishtabhyaham idam krishnam ekam shena stuto jagat. With a single fragment of myself, I pervade and support this entire universe. The material world consists of innumerable universes, each one full of innumerable planets, which are all considered to be products of the Supreme Personality of Godhead's material energy. Yet this is only one-fourth of God's creation. The other three-fourths of creation constitute the spiritual world. Among the innumerable planets in only one universe, the so-called scientists cannot understand even the moon and Mars. But they try to defy the creation of the Supreme Lord and His uncommon energy. Such men have been described as crazy. Nunam pramatam kuru de vikarma. Bhagavatam fifth canon. Such crazy men unnecessarily waste time, energy, and money in attempting to defy the glorious activities of Urukrama, the Supreme Personality of God. In this purport, we find out that certainly the spiritual world is inconceivable, but even the material world, how this universe functions, is beyond the intelligence of ordinary human beings. Therefore, Srila Prabhupada is poo-pooing the scientists, calls them so-called scientists. They're trying to understand by speculation the wonderful creation of the cosmos. This is a foolish attempt. Vasishtha Muni long, long ago has already said, no one can measure the glories of the Lord in terms of figuring out the creation. So you may understand some minor points, but to grasp the whole thing, no one has done it, no one has come near doing that. Now, atheistic scientists object that whenever there's something you can't understand and you bring in God, you have stopped all scientific progress and research. Because there's no way that God can be verified by material science. That means you shouldn't talk about God. If you want to be truly progressive as a human being, you only talk about what can be verified by science as known today. But if you, out of so-called humility, say, there must be a God, there must be a designer, then you have just thwarted scientific research. Because as soon as you say God, all research stops. Does it? We are involved in Bhagavad Dharma, the active research work into the Supreme Personality of Godhead. The conclusions are already there, and we are simply purifying our senses so that we can experience the conclusions. We're not trying to speculate the conclusions, we are trying to experience the conclusions that are already there. But atheistic scientists have this idea. As soon as you say God, then there can be no more scientific progress. They give the example of Newton, who couldn't figure out something beyond his gravitational theory. He had done very well, amazingly well, up to a certain point. And he got to that point and then said, well, God is the answer. Then the next generation scientist, I forgot his name, he was just making fun of Newton. Oh, Newton brought in God. Ridiculous. Watch what I do. I'm not shackled by Newton's religious inclinations. And supposedly he came up with the explanation. So this is brought out as an example. Because that scientist was not shackled by beliefs in God, he could push ahead and explain, you know, in scientific terms, what Newton failed to understand. But who has explained everything? Who has explained the source of everything? Who has explained what is life? What is consciousness? No one has done that. But any little, tiny, insignificant victory is bandied about as the proof that what you can do when you get rid of God. It's like, let's say, Ananta Vrindavan's car has broken down. So he tries his best to fix it. He pulls up the bonnet, he gets under there and tries to fix it. Can't really call the neighbors to help you because everyone has a different car these days. In Russia, you can do that. You know, there's so many Ladas around, so everyone knows how to fix a Lada. You know, when a Lada breaks, you can, you know, everyone crowds around, and they, you know, they generally all had the same problem before. You know. So he's under the bonnet, and he can't see what the solution is. Although he's had success before in fixing his car, this one problem he can't solve. It's, well, I guess it's because of God. Then, a more expert mechanic in the neighborhood, you know, his neighbor comes along, you know, looks under the bonnet. Oh, I think we can find the reason why the car is broken. He tinkers around for a while. Ah, this is the reason. So he fixes the car. And then he says, just see, because you believed in God, you could come to the right conclusion. But I just believed in the rational power of science. That's what I've done. How do you solve this problem? Remember Srila Prabhupada's words. We give the scientists full credit for making things like, you know, iPods, DVD players. Very, very significant. We give full credit. But we don't listen when they talk about the creation. They can take full credit for tinkering around with this and tinkering around with that. But when they start talking about what is the origin of life, what is the origin of the universe, we don't listen. Srila Prabhupada explained, this is child's talk. Just like if Sitapati's son Prahlad comes and expounds to us about, you know, how the creation came into being. Just, oh, how cute. Nice little child speaking. So that was little Prabhupada. So that's the attitude we should have for atheistic scientists. Appreciate, you know, their DVD players. Okay, we'll use it in Krishna service. iPods, we'll use it in Krishna service. Camcorders, all right. But just don't talk about the universe. Otherwise, it's a little child speaking. Why is it that you say belief in God stops all scientific progress? It's perfectly possible to go on with your science in a theistic way. Now, one argument given by atheistic scientists is, you say there's a 1 in a billion chance that life could have arisen randomly. And you say that the odds are so high against it. 1 in a billion. Chances are 1 in a billion that life could have arisen randomly without any design or direction. But get this. If you posit that there are billions of universes, and all of them were, in all of them, the evolutionary process was working so that life was trying to develop. There is the possibility that because there are a billion universes, at least one of those billions of universes, life could have arisen by chance, because there's so many universes, you see? So if you just take this universe alone, then you say, it's 1 in a billion odds that life could have arisen by chance. But if there are billions of universes, then suddenly it becomes more credible. So that is the latest religious belief they have. They call it the multiverse theory. There are countless universes, and all those other universes, by random interaction, by random chance, life could not develop. But in this one universe, out of all the billions, life did develop by chance. So they ask you to accept this. Now, naturally you'll say, well, look, if I say I believe in the supreme designer, you say that's stopping all scientific research. But if you say you believe in the multiverse theory, there are billions of universes happening by chance, and therefore it's not so improbable that in one of those billions of universes, life came by chance. That's a belief. You can't prove it. Then they argue, well, at least believing in parallel universes offers some hope of scientific verification. But believe in God, there's no hope. Now, Christians don't know how to argue further from this point. Even the topmost Christian scientists, they just say, well, anyway, my God is a great God. My God can do it. Mm-hmm. And to a skeptical person, that sounds very, how do you say, fanatical and childish. Yeah. When you still just start saying, my God is a good God. My God can do it. And most, a lot of persons just get turned off. Yeah. Your God, huh? Like it's your personal property, your particular slant on reality. My God can do the creation. I've seen even the most brilliant scientists, when they get pushed up to the wall, that's how they respond. In terms of most brilliant Christian scientists, they can't go any further. Well, if we say there are unlimited universes, at least there's some hope one day of scientifically verifying that. But when you say God, then you stop science. There's no hope in ever verifying that point by science. And so generally the Christian scientists agree, yeah, it's true. But anyway, my God is a good God, my God. And, we believe in him. What did the Krishna conscious person say? Through the bhakti procedure, you can verify the existence of Krishna. It's true. Ordinary science cannot directly prove the existence of God. But why should we simply accept ordinary science is the all-in-all. Why not enter the bhakti laboratory? As we are trying to do. Krishna explains in Bhagavad Gita, Pratyaksha Avagamam Dharma. The king of knowledge, the king of all education, the most secret of all secrets, is directly verifiable by the self. And he's speaking of the pure self and pure senses. If you take the trouble to purify your senses, then you'll be able to perceive differently. And the bhakti process is all about purifying your senses so that you can indeed experience and verify the spiritual reality. The greatest need today is for people to become acquainted with the bhakti science. That means they have to expand their understanding of what is science. Why should science only be the way it's perceived by some people today? We're saying that's not the only method of knowing. It's not even the best method of knowing things. Now, near the end of the purport, it is stated, among the innumerable planets in only one universe, the so-called scientists cannot understand even the moon and Mars. But they try to defy the creation of the Supreme Lord and His uncommon energy. Such men have been described as crazy. But just think about it. You try to understand the moon. You try to send various space devices to Mars. And you beat your test. You're so proud. But those planets are just specks of dust in a universe with countless planets. And even this one universe is just a speck of dust amongst countless universes. For us, there's no problem with the multiverse theory, except that they say all the other universes that they posit the existence of, they are not able to support life because the odds, the chance, the random interactions didn't work out. But only in this universe is there life. But no, we take the Vedic version. Every universe is suitable for life. So, Lord Chaitanya, in speaking to Vasudeva Dutt, commented about how insignificant just one universe is. Vasudeva Dutt wanted to take all the sinful reactions of everyone in the universe on his shoulders so the whole universe could go back to Godhead. And Lord Chaitanya told him, you don't have to do that. What's the big deal if everyone in this universe goes back to Godhead? This can be arranged by the Lord if He wants. This universe is just like a mustard seed in a bucket of mustard seeds. Everyone has seen a mustard seed, how tiny it is? You know how tiny a mustard seed is? So, suppose you carry into the kitchen or out to your festival cooking site, prasad distribution, you've got a bucket of mustard seeds, and one falls out. Who is ever in anxiety about that? Yes. You have seen a stack of mustard seeds before? And suppose one got lost. Do you collapse on the ground in grief? So, Lord Chaitanya said, similarly, if one universe happens to disappear, it is nothing but a supreme personality of Godhead. But this is real cosmology. Yet, atheistic scientists beat their chests about some limited understanding of the moon and Mars that they have, just to inspire the people. Just like when the first Russian cosmonaut, went around the Earth, back in the 50s, I guess it was. He went all over the world to countries that had some affection for the former Soviet Union. He even went to India. He was treated as a great Mahajan. And he told everyone how when he was orbiting the Earth, he was looking out the window of the space capsule, trying to see, where is my Moscow? He's so far away. Yeah, where is that place I took birth in? I don't know if... it may have been publicized in Australia. It was publicized in New Zealand, but not in the USA. And not in Europe. Switzerland, there was a tiny mention of it. devotees told me they saw it in the newspapers. But a few months ago, NASA, the American Space Agency, admitted they have lost the original moon films. No one in America knows this.
It was an Australian who actually asked for it.
So, can you imagine the great step forward? And now, the documentary evidence of the original, because the technology, the computer technology, is so advanced these days, they can take films and analyze them quite easily. So it's a good time to lose the original. So these things are going on. Therefore, we read, such men have been described as crazy. Nunam pramata kuru deva karma. Such crazy men unnecessarily waste time, energy, and money in attempting to defy the glorious activities of Guru Krama, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. All right, any questions? Yes.
Earlier on in the chapter, I'm not sure if it's this chapter or the previous chapter, Srila Prabhupada talks about sadhana cities and creeper cities, and how Bali Maharaj was a creeper city. Mm-hmm. And I'm just curious how he obtained that.
Prahlad Maharaj. He's the grandson of Prahlad Maharaj. He got the seed from Prahlad Maharaj, of the Kripa, and then in association with Lord Vamadeva, that seed became fully manifest. Yes?
Guru Maharaj, I have a question. When Vani Maharaj got the benedictions from Vamadeva, why did Ramanadev didn't take him directly to the spiritual world, but give him a position as the Indra and give him a planet?
Why didn't he
give him a sentence directly to the spiritual world?
Because obviously Lord Vamadeva had plans for Bali for a while in the material world. So he gave him Sutala and made it more opulent than Indra's plan. And even the Lord himself went there to be Bali's doorman. Can you imagine the Supreme Personality of Godhead at your new home becoming the doorman? That's what he did for Bali Maharaj. He wanted Bali Maharaj to demonstrate how to live in this world as a powerful sovereign monarch on behalf of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Unless people see that or are able to hear about it, they won't believe it. It's possible. Yes?
How do we understand the idea of sudden city with the idea that it's not possible to, just like the Christian who says, it's not possible to achieve salvation through your own kind of activities and works, and we also say that the sinning process is it's not possible to reach perfection through your own efforts and endeavors, like we've preached to people about that.
Ascending process means trying to understand the inconceivable with your tiny brain. Speculation. But our following sadhana is not the ascending process. It's the descending process. We're taking the techniques from the Siddha succession for how to become God conscious. So it's sadhana, yes, and we have to apply ourselves, but the very sadhana process is coming from the mercy of Lord Chaitanya. Otherwise we have no qualification to approach such sadhana. So the mercy is coming to us in the form of the Bhakti Lata Bij, the seed of the Bhakti Lata, the creeper of devotion. That seed contains the instructions necessary to advance in spiritual life. If we water that seed, the plant will grow. Why does the plant grow when you water the seed? Because of the mercy of Lord Chaitanya. So you're accepting of the process that Lord Chaitanya is giving means you're accepting the mercy of Lord Chaitanya. So therefore a devotee always understands, as Kaviraj Goswami says, for one who remembers Lord Chaitanya, difficult things become easy, and for one who forgets Lord Chaitanya, easy things become difficult. And as we were discussing at Saki Roy's house Monday night, we read the verse, first verse, the seventh chapter of Adi Lila, Chaitanya Charitamrita. Lord Chaitanya is the only meaning for those seeking to advance in spiritual life. All right. Thank you very much, Adikas.